by Emerson Nafziger, and he will be talking about how many NRA trials do we need?
The answer that gets us up in the morning is more. No, that's not really true. I'm doing something a little bit different today. I was tempted to respond to the previous speaker, but I don't think you're supposed to do that here. But we're going to look at a data set that we have. It's part of the MRTN database in Illinois that we generated and sort of asked this question. It's one that I think I've been thinking about for 20 years or so. You know, when do you say stop if you have trials at a site, given the variability that we know exists from year to year in the same set of plots, and we'll talk about that a little bit. Very briefly, I wanted to give credit. This is really Adam Davis did the work on this. He's an ecologist, weed ecologist with ARS at the University of Illinois, and my colleague Maria Villamil and I. So this came out of work that a master's student did, and we were kind of curious about this. So it's a work in progress, and I'm going to give you some verbiage today that I don't usually use, and I told John Sawyer and Fabian that I was going to take up all my time so you couldn't ask any questions, because I don't know what I'd answer you. But very simply, for a 10-year period, we did a fertilizer checkoff-funded N-rate study at seven fields in Illinois. You see the sites there. Down at Dixon Springs, we had an upland and a bottomland site. And very simply, we had corn following corn and corn following soybean. The corn following corn, of course, the nitrogen rate stayed in the same plots every year for the 10. And in corn following soybean, they flip back and forth in two main plots, as you'd expect, with soybean 1 year and corn the next in that same plot, with the rates also staying in their place. These are the soil types at the locations, and as you can expect in northern Illinois, the top four there, they're pretty productive soils, and at southern Illinois sites, they're less productive, and the yield expectations are lower. One of the reasons we developed the MRTN was to take care of the fact that yield goal-based nitrogen recommendation systems did not work equally from northern to southern Illinois. And in fact, they were too low for southern Illinois, in many cases too high, and getting even higher for northern Illinois. So that's why we gave up on the yield goal-based N recommendation system. I was going to take up all my time just showing you these the 14 of these that we have, but this gives you probably the most consistent site we had in the year-to-year variation. That's just one line for each of the 10 years. And, the answer to the question, how many nitrogen rate trials, we would have probably said about three in this case. The problem is you never really know when you start these things out. But this one's a very nice and consistent one. On the other side of the spectrum is this one. This is an upland site down in southern Illinois, which is often constrained. Yields are constrained by lack of water. And you can just see what happened over the 10 years there. Now, if you ask the question, how many of these do you need before you're confident that you've got a good nitrogen rate pinned down, the answer, I think, is probably into three digits. So the guiding questions we had when we start doing N-rate trials like this, when can we stop? When do we have confidence that we know enough? And how many samples is enough, in other words, to characterize the population of EONRs? Can we shorten this time, that is, can we predict it for a given site year from site conditions and early season weather? And this is the second part of the question. I didn't ask that question in the title. I just made that title up to get you to come. And if we can, will the adjustment be enough to make much difference? You know, can we? I think all of us understand that there'd be a great advantage if we could take existing conditions and say, well, this response looked like this, but under another weather situation, we think it would have looked like this, and therefore you can shorten the number of actual trials you do. For most applications we've done in the past, we've used the quadratic plus plateau. If you look at the data, you know, you can, I won't go back and look at, well, I'll look at that, but you can see all kinds of response curves that you can imagine in there, and your imagination would be correct. There's some very straight lines in there. There's some that are quadratic. There's some that are quadratic, but we're still rising out at the left, at the right-hand side. So that's kind of the story. That fits most of, it's a calculated iteratively by the Prock-Enlin procedure, and it fits most end response data well. Many of you here have used this. It's easy to calculate the EONR. You just take the quadratic, the derivative of it, and set it equal to the cost slope. Today, most of what we do, what I'm going to show, is done using an asymptotic function. And we're still having a little bit of a debate about which one's the best one to use. And I'm withholding judgment until we can run through a lot of this. But this one, Dr. Davis fit by maximum likelihood in this package of under R, using the R software. Some responses that plateau, just as an observation, don't reach the asymptote over that same range. Others do. And it's clearly easier to use this for large data sets and modeling. We find that the people, statistically minded people, really like this better than that clumsy quadratic plus plateau. I think, Dr. Villamil, that's correct, right? And the this is a careful difference. I need to point this one out so you remember it. The MRTN base 10 that we're using for 10 years is, in this exercise, is the average of the 10 EONR values. It's not the MRTN as we've calculated it. Those of you who know, have looked at the website, know that we calculate it based on the return, and that has a penalty for over-application, and this one really doesn't. And so they're quite different. In general, the average of the EONRs is going to be less. And I calculate then the MRTN rate. And I calculated it over 150 or 75 the sites the other day, and the difference was about 30 kilograms per hectare lower for this measurement compared to the actual, or the MRTN, the way we've usually calculated it. And for those of you not familiar, this is what this looks like. It's calculated, as I said, and these parameters are calculated in R. This is from DeKalb, corn following corn, in 1999. And that's the fit that you get. And I took the corn following soybean from the same year and fit it using the asymptotic fit and the quadratic plus plateau. This one didn't plateau over the range of rates with the quadratic plus plateau, so the quadratic would fit it fine. And you can see what the asymptotic fit. Those are going to give you somewhat different numbers. In this case, the asymptotic one's probably going to reach an optimum before we run out of nitrogen there on the right-hand side, and the other one very likely will not. So this is the answer to the question in the title, when have we done enough corn response studies in the same site, I should say. And the answer, and we're so fond of, is it depends on how accurate you want to be. This is a power analysis, and it shows that at alpha 0.05 with 10 years of data per location, well, that's the basis of the simulation here, or the analysis. And you can see there, if you want your margin of error to be 10% of the mean, depending on what site you're at, it's going to take somewhere between 3 or 4 years. That bottom one there, I think, is that this is a previous crop corn. The bottom one, I believe, is the DeKalb site. And if you're at another site in southern Illinois where you get drought and the real wide range of responses there, it could take 80 or 90, or, well, not that many, 30 or 40, 25 to 30 there where that crosses that vertical line. On the right-hand side, when the previous crop was soybean, the answer is actually not very different, which surprises me. We tend to think that corn following soybean is more consistent in its response, and it turns out it may not be. So that's the answer to that question. This was at an alpha level of 0.2, and honestly, I can't stand here and tell you which one's the more useful one. And you can see there that this improves things a little bit. Now, with 10 years of data, we can be within 10%. But, you know, it takes a lot of years of data to get very much better than that, as you can imagine. So now we're going to look at the second part of the question. We're going to model covariances among the EONR using soil and climate variables. And this is the steps in the analysis, and I don't really need to go through these. My time is running out. But we do this, as many of you would be familiar with, and I'm going to pretty much skip over that. But just went through this as a very labor, computer-intensive process to do all of this, and Adam did a great job with it. So this is observed in EONR and the MRTN, and this just shows you kind of the raw data set. This is at one of our sites, Monmouth, with the low nitrogen price of 60 cents per kilogram of nitrogen. And you can see the MRTN, that's the average of those 10 EONR values versus the observed EONR for each year at that one. These tend to be pretty much on top of each other, and on average you expect they are, the averages are equal. This is at the high price, and as you can imagine, these are pushed back to the left to lower EONR rates. And you can just get a sense there from how these look like when they're done. This is Urbana, and pretty much the same set of data. Again, there is some disparity in some years with these where they don't really fit what the average was. But, you know, that's sort of what we would expect. So if you want to predict these then from soil and weather properties, how do you do it? And this is the exercise. In this case, it's not a completed one yet, but the range was in planting date, the length of window 0 to 60 within that range, weather variables that are listed there, soil variables as are listed there, and then an optimization routine where you generate these weather windows, you run it through partial least squares to determine the strongest signal. I really like this. It's shaped like a fish. I should have put scales on it. But this shows you that of the top 15% of loadings, they were most closely related to the growing degree day base 10C. And I don't think that one had a top limit on it, as far as I know. But that just tells you what was giving some strength to improving the performance. So in a multiple regression then, these were all modeled, and my time is up. But this shows you which factors were significant in this. But if you look at the plot of the observed versus the predicted EONR, you're saying that's not really improving it very much, is it? And you would be correct. Statistically, it's significant in terms of actually giving a lot of strength, extra strength to an individual site year, as getting to the truth, if you would. They're not contributing very much, let's put it that way. So this is the all of the site years. This is the low price after corn. This is the high price following corn. It's pretty much the same story. The list of things there that are significant changes a little bit, but you know, some of them are in common. This is after soybean, the low price, and after soybean, the high price of nitrogen. So yes, there's statistically, you can see there down at the bottom, the p-values of all of those are significant, but the actual improvement is somewhat limited. So comparing these prediction methods, now we have a predicted EONR versus an observed one, and the predicted is the blue triangle there. The observed one is the open diamond for EONR values each year. The observed MRTN base 10 there stays in place. That's the same for all of these graphs. And this is again at that same site. So you can see they're typically pretty close to one another, as you would hope they would be. At least they're not wildly different. And this is at Urbana with the low price and at Urbana with the high price. And we threw this Brownstown one in. The 2002, if you look at it in the upper right, that was a flatliner, I call them, where we got no response at about a 20 bushel yield level. But when you did this modeling, then it gives it a response. You understand? I mean, it's giving it a response because there's a response everywhere else. So you look at that and say, there's no EONR of a flat line. But when you do this modeling, it includes it. Dropping it out, in other words, that site probably isn't going to change the model very much. And that's the same thing for that we see here at the higher price. And we'll skip that one because my time is up. And this is just a comparison of the cumulative dollars spent, either positive or negative. And I'm not sure why that site, the one site with the high bars, is the uplands, the lowland site at Dixon Springs, and it really shouldn't look like that. I don't know why it does. Most of the other ones are fairly close, showing that this, you know, predicting these is giving us just a very modest improvement, not a very big one. A little bit more at the higher end price than at the lower end price. But this is the kilograms of nitrogen equivalent to the one I just showed you. So in summary, the power analyses show that at alpha 0.05, 10 years of data gets you to a margin of error about 15%. It takes 25 to 30 to get to 10%. Previous crop does not have a large effect. At alpha is 0.2, 10 years gets you to about 10%. And using selected weather and soil data, partial least squares regression shows that GDD base 10 in the 30 days before and after influences the predicted EONR. But using a multiple regression approach, we can improve these values modestly. And predicted EONR per site year was quite close to the observed one for most of the site years, produced slightly more profit at the higher end price. The work continues. Thanks.